Good morning, everybody. Awesome to see you today on this beautiful weekend. It feels like September. I mean, hopefully you got out this weekend and were walking around doing something outside. Well, we're continuing our series looking at the names of God, and we're going to jump into another name. And I was just thinking this week about one of the most exciting fights that are coming up. If you're into boxing or UFC, one of the most highly anticipated boxing matches that in recent years that we can even remember is about to happen as Floyd Mayweather, who is an undefeated champion, he's 40 years old, he's going to be fighting an Irishman named Conor McGregor, who is not really in boxing strictly. He is a UFC fighter. He holds two belts in two different weight classes, and he's going to basically, McGregor has said, I'm not going to wrestle you or use jiu-jitsu. I'm not going to kick you. I'm not going to do any of those things. We're just going to box. And it's a highly anticipated match as we wait and see if Mayweather, who is arguably one of the most decorated fighters, he's certainly undefeated and a great, great defensive fighter, if he'll prevail, or the guy who's a UFC fighter, if he'll prevail. And as the buildup takes place to these fights, this fight, it's amazing the amount of trash talking. I mean, these guys are masters at the trash talk. They're talking about how they're greater and superior and how they're going to beat the other down, and they use all kinds of props and words to do it. And the argument really comes down to this, that they make no secret of their feelings that they are, without a doubt, the greatest. They're the greatest. And it raises the question, who really is the greatest? I mean, people can rise to the pinnacle of a sport, or they can certainly be someone who gets a lot of accolades and praise for the things that they accomplish. But, you know, who is the greatest? I mean, if we were talking golf, we'd say maybe Jordan Spieth is the greatest golfer. Or we're talking about women entrepreneurs. It'd be Elizabeth Holmes, who's worth $4.5 billion. I mean, that's pretty successful. The richest woman entrepreneur in the world. And even this past week, if you're following the news, you'll see that Jeff Bezos is now the richest man in the world. He passed Bill Gates. He's worth just about $90 billion. Like with a B, like big time money. And so there are people who reach the pinnacle of success and power. There are presidents who have vast power. There's people with a lot of authority. But who is the greatest power? Is there anyone superior to all this? Is there anyone who's greater that can make human greatness look really small? And the answer is yes. Today, I want to look at the name, another name for God. We've looked at a number of names. We're going to look today at El Elyon. And this is the Most High God. People can certainly ascend to a certain height. But in the end, there is only one Most High, and that is God himself. And the first time we come across this name is in Genesis 14. And here we see God revealing himself to Abram as El Elyon, the Most High God. And it happens at a time where Abram has already been introduced to God. Abram already knows that God has a plan for his life, that he's interacted with God and understands that God has basically come to him and said, you are going to be great, Abram. You're going to have descendants. Even though you have no children right now, your descendants will be great. The land that you're on, you will occupy, and your descendants will occupy as well. And so there's already a sense that Abram is getting an idea as to who this God is, but he's learning more all the time because God's names are like windows into his character and his nature. They help us understand further the depth and multifacetedness of who God is. And now he's about to learn something new. It takes place in Genesis 14. And here, just to set this passage up, we have the first war in the scriptures. In fact, this may be a description in Genesis 14 of the first war in human history. Five kings have set up battle lines against four kings, and they're fighting it out, they're duking it out, and we're going to see what happens as they fight and as they battle and who prevails. And let's pick up the story in Genesis 14, verse 11, says the four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and their food, and they went away. They also carried off, after this great victory of these four kings over five, they carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions, since he was living in Sodom. One who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and Aner, all whom were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and other people. And so what has happened here is that these four kings have set up battle lines against the five, and they've prevailed in battle. And what has happened now is that Sodom, the king of Sodom, is on the losing end of the battle. He's one of the losers. He's one of those five kings. And the winners then enter Sodom, and they invade the city, and they plunder the city. And in the process, they take Lot, Abram's nephew, and his family, and they take them into captivity. And so Abram hears about this and decides, wow, he needs to do something to save his nephew. So he gathers 318 soldiers and men he's trained for battle. And he goes into battle. He comes up with a plan, and he has a strategy, and he mobilizes people, and he goes out and he's successful. He's able to overcome these kings and save his nephew and his family. But he not only rescues Lot and his family from what is likely to be a dismal future in captivity, but also many others, he saves them too. They would have suffered the same exact fate. And you can imagine that after that great victory, Abram's respect, which was already high, is now really going up. It's ascending big time. Abram is someone who's highly respected, and now he's shown himself to be a man of great courage and valor, a man who is very ingenious in his strategic thinking, who mobilizes people, who gets things done, who accomplished a great victory. And word was spreading, his reputation was growing. And the first king to come out to congratulate him on his great victory, of course, is the king of Sodom. He's the one that's gained a lot. He's really recovered. His life was likely over. His people would have been captive, his city sacked. And so he comes out and he's grateful. He's overwhelmed with gratitude, immense respect for this great achievement from this great man. The second person that Abram meets is a man named Melchizedek, who is the priest of Salem, or the priest of Jerusalem. And he brings bread and wine for Abram's weary man to celebrate this amazing victory. And it's at this time, at the pinnacle of Abram's success, at this moment of great achievement where all the accolades are coming his way, where there's a lot of fanfare about how great he is and how his greatness is increasing, that God comes to Abram and reveals a new name, gives a new window into the character of this man, of who God is, into this window into God's nature. We see this in Genesis 14, verse 18. Then Melchizedek, the second one to greet Abram after this victory, after saving Lot, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine, and he was a priest of the God of God Most High. And he blessed Abraham, saying this, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, El Elyon, creator of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, El Elyon, who delivered your enemies into your hands." Here God reveals himself to Abraham as El Elyon, and it speaks of God as high and holy, as sovereign over the affairs of men, as someone who is superior and greater than all, who basically, with his overruling providence, is overseeing all things that happen in this world. And the affairs of men are controlled, and ultimately he ensures a certain outcome. He cannot be thwarted. He is truly the unstoppable God. What he says, what he desires, what he wills has to happen, will happen. He always, always prevails. He's El Elyon. He's the Most High God. And here Abram gets a sense of the fact that El Elyon is not the distant God that we've talked about over the last few weeks, or he's distant, maybe he doesn't care. No, God is not that way. He's transcendent. He's imminent as well. But here we get a picture of how El Elyon is working behind the scenes in Abram's life, working behind the scenes in the political movements of the day, working behind the scenes in people's lives and in how things play out day by day. He's working behind the scenes to secure this great victory. And Abraham, yes, he exercised his will. He gathered people. He mobilized his people. He had a strategy and plan. But God is the one who enabled him to carry out this plan. He equipped him and empowered him. And in fact, it is El Elyon who is the ultimate source of Abram's success. That God is intimately involved in this world and in his life and in all that took place. That God is orchestrating things behind the scenes. He's using Abram's gifts and abilities and passions, no doubt about it. He's using Abram's energy, no doubt about it. He's shifting scenarios around and ultimately intervening in a certain way. He's opening and closing doors. These things are not accidental. These things are not just happenstance, but El Elyon is working behind the scenes in all these things. And there's really something special about Abram here. And his name has not been changed to Abraham yet. God changes his name later. But it's Abram now, and there's something special about him. Because Abram relishes his victory. He relishes his victory. He accepts the accolades of the people and the praise of the people. He accepts the expressions of gratitude. He knows that he's gifted. He knows that he's capable. It's quite obvious that he's gifted and capable, and that what he's thought of and conceived of and carried out, he generated this. This is a big, big deal. He understands his giftedness. But he also knows that his actions alone don't fully explain the triumph. He also knows that there is something more happening, that God has made it possible for him to claim this great victory. And as a result, he doesn't let his success, he doesn't let his victory, he doesn't let what he's accomplished go to his head. He doesn't become proud of it. He doesn't boast in it. He doesn't take all the credit for what's taken place. He understands somehow that God is working. And he remembers back to the first time he met God, when God said that God would make him great. God would make him great. And now it was happening. And what's amazing here is that Abram somehow gets this, that God is working behind the scenes. He somehow understands that all this is happening with God's handwork all over it. And it's not always easy for us to see that. Because ultimately, I think, just as suffering tests our faith, so does success. It's amazing that Abram gets this. Because just as suffering tests our faith, so does success. Suffering, when we suffer and go through problems, we just did a whole series on rain and on suffering and problems in our lives. And we all suffer. We all have problems. We all have difficulties. We all face challenges. It's part and parcel of this life. And so when we suffer, sometimes we say, God, where are you? And why aren't you answering? And I pray and you don't hear me. And why aren't you intervening? And I've got some ways that you could step into this and you're not doing it. And wow, why don't you do it this way or that way? It would make a lot more sense to me. And so we struggle and we ask a lot of questions when we suffer. But we are also tested when things go well, when our plans prosper, when we achieve a big victory, we get the promotion, when we're acknowledged for something we've accomplished, when we close the deal, when we triple the value of the company, when we get the trophy or we're handed the award. It's in those moments of success that a deep spiritual test begins as well. When people applaud us as they did Abram and say, wow, you're special, you're amazing, look what has happened, that's incredible. When we've basically done something that others acknowledge, the test begins. It's a spiritual test because success tests us just as suffering does. And it's in those moments that we, like Abram, have a choice. We can become proud. We can begin to start reading our press clippings and thinking, wow, you know, and listening to other people. Wow, yeah, I guess I am special. I guess maybe I am a little bit higher level than some other people. Some people even begin to treat others differently because they feel like they're better or superior or smarter or richer or more capable. And they begin to look down on other people that they're not at the same level. The huge danger here is pride. Pride that goes to our head, that pride that feels justified in seeing ourselves higher than others. Pride that forgets that it's God who's working behind the scenes. Pride that forgets that no matter how high we get or what pedestal other people put us on, that eventually pedestals go away. And that the pedestals that we may even unwittingly build for ourselves, they go away. Because there's really only one Most High God. There's only one who's high above all others, and that's not me or you or anybody on this planet. It's God alone. He alone is Most High. And I love how Abram, who no doubt faced this temptation, responds. I love how he steps into this spiritual test and he reacts in a way that is really interesting, that I didn't see coming, but I think is really powerful. In Genesis 14, we see his reaction, his response to this revelation of God as El Elyon, the Most High. Then Abram gave him, that is Melchizedek, a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, I've raised my hand to the Lord God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. Abram responds to this moment of success in two ways. The first way is that he brings a tenth of everything he has to Melchizedek in honor of El Elyon, that God is the Most High. And I think it's a powerful moment because it speaks of how God loves when we acknowledge him in this way. And we acknowledge God's greatness when we give back to him some of what he's given to us. That we actually acknowledge God's greatness when we give back to him some of what he's given to us. God is honored when we see him as the ultimate source of our success and even our financial success. God is honored when we put him first in this way. And in fact, the tithe that he brings here is very important because it's something that speaks of his commitment in acknowledging God's greatness. That's what the tithe is. It's a commitment, acknowledging God's greatness. Now, some people have said that, well, the tithe is an Old Testament concept. It's rooted in the law. And now that we're in the New Testament in grace, that it doesn't apply. But here we see that Abram gives a tithe to El Elyon in honor of God, to acknowledge God before the law is given. In other words, the tithe doesn't expire. It's not something that's just an old rooted in Old Testament law. Here it precedes the giving of the law. And so it's something that is applicable to all people in all time. And here the tithe is not meant to be something cumbersome or onerous. It's not meant to be a religious duty that we do. And it's like, wow, it's drudgery. Like, wow, oh, this is awful. No, but it's not onerous. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to express gratitude to the God who is behind the scenes, who's working all things, who's given us breath and ability, open doors and opportunity. And we now have the opportunity to give back just a little of what he's given to us. It's a recognition that all we have comes from his hand, the ability to think, the ability to be creative, the ability to generate thoughts and ideas and move things forward, that El Elyon is behind all these things. When we tithe, we make that acknowledgement. And in fact, here we have a picture of how Abram says, I'm going to put you in first place in my life. That's what this is. You know, sometimes we think of giving like, well, does God need our money? And God doesn't need our money, but he wants to be in first place in our lives. And that includes first over everything, including our finances. Abram, in giving this tithe, is saying, I reserve the top spot for you. And there's something else that happens here with Melchizedek that explains this giving a little bit further. In ancient cultures, there was this sense that to the victors go the spoils. That was the kind of how it worked. And so the king of Sodom fully expected that once Abram saved the people, saved Lot and the people, that Abram would take all the stuff. And so Sodom, the king of Sodom says, just let me have the people. Let me have the people. You can have the gold and the silver and the cattle, and you can have all that kind of stuff. Because, I mean, to the victor goes the spoils. That's how this works. But Abraham surprisingly refuses to take the money, refuses to take the gold and the resources and the flocks and the cattle. In verse 23, he says, I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, I made Abram rich. I think it's important to see something here, that Abraham doesn't say, you know, I can't take this because I cannot be rich. I can't have anything. He doesn't say that. It's not saying here that having things, being well off, having money or land or riches is wrong, because it's not wrong. It's not wrong, you know, to have things, to, you know, have financial success. These things are not wrong. Abram doesn't say here he doesn't want to ever become rich. In fact, he did. He became exceedingly wealthy. He became exceedingly well off, but just as suffering is a test, so is success a deep spiritual test. It can be a blessing, it can be a curse. And we're tested in our culture today because we're always told that money and material things should be the most important thing in our lives. It should be A1 priority. And we face a lot of pressure today to make things our ultimate goal. You know, we think about Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor. They're flashing all kinds of cash at each other. Like, man, I got $1 million check, and they're doing all this because it's all about power. It's all about money. Some people will do anything for money. They want to flash what they have and show the world all that they've accumulated and acquired and how great they are that way. And some people will do anything for more. There are people who will neglect their families so that they can work more and have more money. There are people who will rob banks and steal from their employers and cheat on their taxes and do all these kinds of things to make more money. Many will just give a tip to God and say, here's a little something for you, God, or a little tip to charity, but never really give much more. Some people get flashy, but others go the other extreme because money is the most important thing. They become frugal. I had a distant relative who was very frugal, did not spend any money on anything, and acquired a lot over time. But you know what happens when over time you acquire stuff? The same thing that happens to every single other human being on the planet. You die and you leave it all behind. And so these people, these distant relatives of mine, they never enjoyed the money that they did have, never took trips or enjoyed it, which is perfectly great, and they never used it as an opportunity to serve other people, to bless others. They died, and they lost the opportunity to use their resources for bigger things, and that's a shame. And ultimately, we always face the temptation of holding our resources tightly because there's a new God that's very prominent in our age that few talk about. There's a new God, a God with great power that wants to be invisible behind the scenes but has big influence on your life and mine. It's the God of freedom, that we want to be free. We want to be free to work or not to work, or free to buy things or free not to buy things, free to travel or not travel, free to get the stuff we want or stuff we don't want. But ultimately, this struggle with material things is not new. It's something everyone in every age faces. Abram faced it as well. And this is what is huge here. This is what I love about this story, because Abram, again, doesn't say that being rich is wrong or having money is wrong. The root of all evil is not money. It's not money. It's the love of money. But Abram, however, made an important decision here. He decided this. He decided that if he were to become rich, if he were to become rich, it would only be after he put God first in his finances. If he were to become wealthy, it would only happen after he gave the tithe to God. If he were to become exceedingly well off, it would only come after he entrusted his financial situation fully into God's hands. Abram refused to become rich by neglecting the Most High God. He refused to become rich by making anything else other than God his foremost priority. His goal was not to become rich. His goal was not to keep all the stuff. His goal was not to keep all the spoils for himself. And there's the temptation, because our culture says, keep all the spoils for yourself. But Abraham said, no, I'm not going to keep all the spoils for myself, because that's not my goal. My goal is first and foremost to honor El Elyon, to honor the Lord. And if after tithing and giving and putting God first, God wants to bless me more, then that's God's decision. But it's not mine. I will put him first in this important area of my life. And so as we look at this, we see that in so many ways, Abram gets things right. He gets the humility part right. He gets the seeing God working behind the scenes part right. He gets this idea of passing the success test by putting God first in his finances right. He puts down his pride. He sees clearly. He gives God the credit. He understands that God has enabled him and given him power. And it's El Elyon who's directing things all the time. But there's something else we need to know about El Elyon. This Most High God, this name, is linked to another name in the Bible, another very important name. And the Psalms help us get a handle on and what God promises to do for you and for me when we put El Elyon first in our lives, when our highest priority is nothing else but him. He links another name to El Elyon, and we find that in Psalm 91, verse 1 and 2. It says, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High, El Elyon, will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. Here the psalmist links two names, the Most High God, El Elyon, and then this new name, the Almighty. It's El Shaddai. This is significant because when we acknowledge the Most High God with our lives, with our time, our treasure, our talent, when we put him first in our lives, we then begin to unlock this understanding of who El Shaddai is. When we put El Elyon first, another window opens into God's character. Another power and resource is made available to us, to God's faithful people, because El Elyon is also El Shaddai. El Shaddai is translated Almighty, but most scholars say that's not adequate. There's much more to him than just power. Otherwise, it would be the same. Both names would be synonymous, and that's not what's happening here. The root word here is something we would never expect when God has just been talking about his power. It's a word we would never expect when God is just talking about his greatness and his authority and how he ascends and is worthy of our praise in all these ways. He uses a word that we're like, wow, this is like 180. He flips this around in a huge way and shifts the metaphor from power and might to something way more intimate. The root word for El Shaddai actually is used 18 times to refer to a woman's breasts, to breastfeeding. God is using in the Bible a breastfeeding metaphor. And it's interesting because I have four kids, and when we had our kids, the doctors and nurses always said, well, you know, breastfeeding, you should do this. And so it was a high priority. And many women do, and some try, and others don't. Even today, breastfeeding has gained a lot of acceptance. And so in society, people will breastfeed. We even have a room. If you're breastfeeding, we have a room, a breastfeeding mother's room back there for you. So it's important. And whether you as a mom or any of us are familiar with breastfeeding, it's something that brings images to our mind of closeness, of bonding, of bringing a child close to us. There's an intimacy in it. It speaks of connection and closeness and nourishment and the sustenance, the unique sustenance that a mother can alone can provide for her baby. And what's interesting is this is exactly what El Shaddai does for his faithful people. This is exactly what the Most High God does. He is Most High. He is powerful and awesome and highly lifted up. He's transcendent. He's unequaled and unmatched in every way. We are to humble ourselves before him. But if that's all we knew of God, that he was great and awesome, well, then maybe we would be fearful of him. Maybe we would just tremble in his presence. Maybe we would run and be terrified of how great and awesome he is and how small we are. Maybe that's how we would feel, but that's not the totality of who God is. He's not merely El Elyon. El Elyon is also El Shaddai, a God who is intimate and close. It speaks of his comfort, his sustenance, his consolation. He provides bountifully for us. He is all sufficient. He is all sufficient. He is all we need. He's not just great, but he also takes care of his people. He's not just awesome and transcendent. He's close. He wants to hold us. He's El Shaddai. And I think it says to us that we acknowledge God's greatness when we trust him to take care of us. We acknowledge God's greatness when we allow God to reach out and pull us close to himself, that he provides all that we need. He provides all the comfort we need. And when we acknowledge him, he will prove his care. He will prove that he's the God of all comfort. God wants more than anything for you and me to turn to him and to lean on him, to allow us to pull him close, pull us close. But we can't wrap this up without saying one more thing. Because there's one more piece to this that is a little puzzling. And it has to do with this king of Salem, the priest of Salem, the priest of Jerusalem, Melchizedek. It's puzzling because Melchizedek suddenly appears in the Bible. Boof, he's there. And then, boom. He's gone. It's like he's there, and he's gone. What happened to him? Where did he go? And people have speculated and wondered over time where you know, did he go and what's going on? And Abram brings a tithe to him and pays homage to him, sees him as a spiritual superior, which is just odd. And you're like, who is Melchizedek and what has happened? Scholars talk about how in the rest of the Bible there are references to Melchizedek. One is in Psalm 110, where it says that the Messiah, the coming Messiah, would come from the line, the order of Melchizedek. As we fast forward into the New Testament, we see, Hebrews tells us, that Jesus himself came from the order of Melchizedek. Some see Melchizedek as a type, as a foreshadowing of Jesus. That when he gave his tithe and gave his offering and gave his heart and homage to Melchizedek, he was really giving it to Jesus. Some even go further. They say that he's not a type. He's actually the pre-incarnate Christ. That he's what theologians call a theophany. That God himself, Jesus, always existed. But before he was born as a baby, he came to this earth and revealed himself to Abram in this way, through Melchizedek. That it was not a man, but it was Jesus. Regardless of how we see it, what we know is that El Elyon is Jesus. That El Shaddai, what is said of him, is said of Jesus as well. We see that there is one name that is most high. Philippians 2, 9 through 11 says, therefore God exalted him, Jesus, to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name. Jesus, in fact, is the highest name. He is El Elyon. He is the one to whom everyone will give homage. Every knee will bow to him. Every tongue will confess that he's Lord. Everyone will acknowledge that there is no one greater, that he is most high. But he is also, Jesus is also El Shaddai, the one who provides bountiful supply, who is all sufficient, who meets all our needs. So Jesus answers the question for us. Who is the greatest? Who is the greatest? He is the Most High. He is the all-sufficient one. And he is the only one worthy of our worship, worthy of our praise, worthy to be at the top of what is most important in our lives. He's the only one worthy of our foremost devotion, and we give him all the praise. Let's pray.